This podcast is about your future. What if the next years of your life can be the best years of your life? When full-time work becomes optional, you'll have the time to do all the things you've always wanted to do, if only you had the time. And soon you will. But to make the most of it, you'll need to be well prepared, and that goes well beyond your financial planning. Each week, your host, Joe Casey, is inviting you into conversations with his guests to bring you insights, inspiration, and practical ideas to design your new life, a life you'll build around what matters most to you and on your own terms. Let's get started.
What's it like to reinvent yourself and create a second act career? Today, we have a special guest who had a successful career early and is in the process of pivoting to a new direction. And she's doing it having gone back to school. For 20 years, Brett Anderson was the lead singer of the female rock group The Donnas and performed on Saturday Night Live, David Letterman, and Late Night with Conan O'Brien. And then she made a pivot, which began with going back to school, first at LA City College, where she was valedictorian, and transferred to Stanford University, where in 2019 she received a degree in psychology. And this year, she earned a Master's of Science in Gerontology at the University of Southern California and a Master's in Social Work at UCLA. So, Brett, thanks so much for taking the time to join us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
So, after a highly successful 20-year run in the music industry, what led you to go back to school?
Well, that's sort of a two-sided answer, I would say, because, you know, one side of it is interest and having some avenues that I hadn't explored yet. And another was just necessity. I just really needed to start a new path because it's not that the band ended or music dried up or anything, but it did get more difficult to make a living off of music. I would say in the beginning, we were playing shows and selling records, and that's how we made our living, which is amazing. It's kind of rare to be able to do that. And I was very grateful. And then as gas got more expensive and music started to be able to be downloaded for free, it was much harder to make money off of that. And so we ended up kind of making money off of t-shirts. And, you know, like if I had wanted to sell t-shirts, I just would have done a whole different career.
So what was it like to be an older student?
See, I think I tried not to think of myself as an older student. I think age is just one factor in our identity, and it's actually not a very informative one. If you think about, we try to make generalizations about men and women, you know, it's like that's half of humanity. I think age is up there. There are a lot of people who are 42 right now, and I have stuff in common with some of them, and I don't have much in common with a lot of them. And I kind of took that attitude as an older student too. I really didn't ever think of myself as an older student. I just looked for things I had in common with people and I tried to relate to them instead of, you know, it's really easy to fall into the trap of being like, well, in my day, you know, or comparing and contrasting, you know, laughing when people say they were born the year Forrest Gump came out, but like your mind, we have magnifying minds, you know, and they inflate what we focus on. So if I'm going to focus on our me being different because I'm old, I'm going to create that reality. And I just chose not to do that.
I meant to say, quote unquote, older student. I was myself a real bona fide older student, but I appreciate your point. You mentioned identity too, and that's an interesting thing to think about. You really, I'm sure, having now a different identity than you did, say, a number of years ago. What have you noticed about building a new identity?
Well, I'm actually doing it right now. I just graduated on the 13th of May, which is what, about 12 days ago. And for the first time, I'm not a student. The last 10 years in my life, I've been a student. I've taken a class every semester, even off semesters for 10 years. So this is another crazy identity shift for me. And I've done it before, so I kind of know like what tools to put in my backpack, but it's difficult. I mean, I think one way to look at it is just to try to not be too attached to your identity. I think people get really attached to the idea of saying, I'm this kind of person, I'm not that kind of person. Even like a dog person. I was not a dog person until I met my fiance, and now I have a dog that I love more than most people. Like, we can change. So yeah, your identity can change.
I am also a former not dog person who's become one as well, because my wife and our youngest daughter, who's now 23, took up raising seeing eye dogs for the blind. So we have three black labs here right now.
Oh, that's so amazing. Wow.
Although I help occasionally. I can't take credit for the raising of them. She's done a great job with that.
That's really cool.
So what kind of dog do you have?
He's a rescue. We got him during the pandemic. We were going to wait until afterwards, but then a lot of stuff happened. The pandemic happened, and then my dad had passed away right before the pandemic, and it just was one of those things where it was like, what are we waiting for? You know, like, let's try to just be happy now.
That's a good slogan. There's been so much that's happened over the last couple of years.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry to hear about your dad.
Thank you. It was a learning experience for sure.
So how did you ultimately become interested in gerontology and aging?
That's a good question. Sometimes it's a mystery even to me, but I will say there, my mom had an influence on me. She was working at the VA for 20-something years doing home-based primary care. So she was seeing mostly older adults or people that were homebound, but a lot of older adults. So I heard, you know, her stories, of course, HIPAA-level privacy approved, but, you know, her stories about her patients, and you feel like you get to know them a little bit. And kind of through that and through her humanizing patients, I started to notice older people when I was out in public and just notice people, you know, talking over them or looking through them, imagining how that would feel. And, you know, as a woman, I do get some of that myself when I'm in a room of men. I get talked over and looked through. But I think it's amplified when you're, especially if you have any kind of physical disability, if you're in a wheelchair and you're physically at a lower level than other people, I think it's really easy to be just, well, what's a good word for it? Like overruled, basically. And for whatever reason, I just was able to put myself in that position and imagine how terrible that would feel. And it made me want to change our environment, change our policy, change our society, change everything, you know, the way that we treat older people in our society.
And as you mentioned, you were in a male-dominated industry at a young age. What was that like? What did you take away from that whole experience?
That was really rough. And I feel like I'm answering all your questions with two answers. One, I'm a Gemini. And two, there's two answers to everything. But it's true in this case too, because there was the side where, you know, in the music world, in our scene, it was very male dominated and the rock scene. And, you know, a lot of the songs are about womanizing, you know, so we kind of took the opposite stance and did a little gender bending, and we wrote a lot of manizing songs and boyizing. Once we signed to a major label, kind of at the executive level, there was a whole other flavor of misogyny. So we would be sitting at these big tables across from men in suits and a couple powerful women too, but the numbers were not representative of our population. And just holding our own in those meetings was, you know, we would write notes beforehand. We would sit together and just almost lock elbows. Like if you can lock elbows without physically locking elbows, that's what we would do to just hold our own in those meetings and keep them from, they would tell us like, drop the instruments and dance. And at that point, you're like, how can I do business with you?
I think they were overmatched in retrospect. I don't think they had a shot. From what I've seen. But so pivoting from one career to another and reinventing yourself can be both exciting and challenging. So my two-part questions are always leading to two-part answers. What have you learned about yourself in the process you're going through now, pivoting from one to the other?
I think the first pivot from being the lead singer in a rock band to being a student among students in a classroom and a worker among workers in the job that I had for the first 4 years of school was just, you know, all about humility. I think, you know, when you have literal spotlight on you, it inflates your ego. But I think the thing that people don't realize is there's sort of like the equal and opposite extreme. So whenever your ego is inflated, you also sort of have this growing compensating insecurity. And I don't know if it's like that for everyone, but it was definitely like that for me. So it was really just a process of getting right-sized, of being confident about the things that I had the right to be confident about, and then like sitting down and shutting up about the things that maybe I didn't know what I was talking about. And it was really hard to tell the difference between those things in the beginning. And you slowly, and with many mistakes, public mistakes, I learned the difference between, you know, the things that I can take credit for and the things that I really shouldn't take credit for.
So really being more grounded, it sounds like.
Definitely. Yeah. Just sort of like, I mean, exactly that. I really don't have anything to add. It is about being grounded and kind of about knowing your limits, you know, knowing your abilities. And what's funny is that now I'm in kind of the opposite side of that, where I'm coming out of school where it's like all about being humble and sort of a little bit invisible. And I've been an intern now for 3 years in different positions where I just try to blend into the wall and be available when someone needs a hand, but not be like that intern. And so now I'm applying to jobs and I'm writing cover letters and I'm fixing my resume, and it's really difficult. I have to get friends to help me to be like, remember all these things you did? You have to put those in there. And it's really tricky.
It's that humility, as you mentioned, now it's right there. You don't have to work at the humility part. They're delivering it to you. But as you mentioned before, too,
unfortunately, it's really hard to go from one extreme to the other with, you know, and it's not just like settle in the middle in this comfortable balance. Like I usually tend to swing from one to the other.
I read something where you were interviewed, where you were talking about, too, the voice in your head, kind of the voice in the back of your head with those different messages. So how have you learned over the years to manage that chatter?
Part of that is kind of naming it. I think I had a kind of a visual experience thinking of it as like a bully in my head. And, you know, there's certain people in my life that I envision as that person, but it really is an amalgamation of a lot of them together. And I thought about it one day, like, it's kind of like a too old trick-or-treater coming to knock on your door for candy. And the first few times you kind of fall for it. Then third or fourth time, you're like, you look at the shoes under the sheet. You're like, you're not a kid. Like, come on, we're not doing this anymore. Like, I'm not giving you candy. Don't knock on my door anymore. Let's move on.
Absolutely. So one thing I see in my work as a coach is that some people really struggle with creating a second act career with the topic of letting go. They've had success, they've really into a particular career, and then it's time to move on to graduate, so to speak, but it's hard to let go. What advice would you offer people who are thinking about building a second act about how to let go?
Well, I think that comes back to identity. You know, you're letting go of your identity and how people know you. And kind of a way that I like to think about that is how you introduce yourself at dinner parties. And I think as a singer of a rock band, like that's, it always works. It's awesome. It was great. Like any place I went and met new people, I was guaranteed for them to be like, wow. And then, you know, I was back in school and that was okay too, you know, but when I started to focus on aging and being interested in addiction and end of life care and hospice and palliative care, those responses get much different. You know, people are, they don't drop everything to hear you wax poetic about your end of life care work. And I think it was, I kind of was aware of it while it was happening, but that doesn't make it any easier to let go of that reaction and to kind of count on that reaction to feel good about myself. And the way that it happened was that, you know, instead of getting these like guaranteed good reactions across the board, I now get these really amazing interactions every once in a while. So you come around to a party and there's like one other person there who's interested in aging, or you join a social work program and there are three other people who are interested in aging, like that becomes your capstone group, or that one person at the party becomes like your best buddy for either that party or past that. So it's kind of like a quantity quality equation.
So you mentioned end of life care and addiction. Curious about what you notice with addiction in older adults coming out, hopefully, of the pandemic. What trends do you see with older adults and addiction that people should be aware of?
Well, I think it's a little bit harder to recognize a lot of the time. And I think people will confuse signs of depression with addiction, with sometimes other conditions altogether that have those symptoms and side effects. And along with side effects comes polypharmacy. So if you're mixing medications and over-the-counter substances and then possibly alcohol or cannabis or cocaine, that's going to do a lot in your body. And I think it's really difficult to kind of untangle which is the problem, which is a side effect, which is a symptom, and where do you even start with a person? But I think if you can identify that there is some substance use, getting rid of that can help you look at all the other stuff and just decipher where the other issues lie.
You mentioned before about having friends remind you of the things you've achieved and what you bring to the table. What would you say some of the strengths are that you bring to the party as a gerontologist that come from all your previous experiences?
I think what I've heard people say is that I make them excited about aging, you know, and I give them sort of permission to not groan and moan and dread it. And it's, you know, not that I'm doing anything that special, but I always bring a different perspective. And a lot of people don't get that perspective in their daily life. So I think that's a benefit that I bring to the table. I also think, you know, having been successful at a young age and knowing that that isn't the answer to my problem of, you know, what am I doing with my life? Where do I find my self-worth? Like, I know that success is external. And I learned that at a young age, you know, and I learned that the VIP room is often a broom closet. You're fighting and fighting and fighting to get deeper and deeper into the club. And it's like, you know, a lot of times that's the back stoop, like that we're fighting to get to. And it's really not that cool. So I feel like I've kind of like unveiled the illusion a little bit. And that helps me be happy in my daily life with what I have.
You mentioned internships. You also had some interesting ones at Stanford.
When I was at Stanford, I was research assistant in the Lifespan Development Lab with Laura Carstensen as the primary investigator. That was amazing. It's funny, sometimes I pretend complain about it because my quote-unquote office was like the coffee room, and I sat next to a mini fridge full of saliva samples that had been there for a really long time. But, you know, that's like another one of the humbling things. And the fact is, I was actually lucky to have a door that I could close, especially because at the time I lived in family housing with my fiance, and it was just like a studio. It's just one room. And so if we wanted some space from each other, we just put on our headphones, but that was our only option. So I was happy to have a door that I could close and just, again, to just be like, to be part of a group of people who are doing really amazing things and just to be able to hear them problem solve over the course of, say, a week to figure out how what you do about this certain problem of how we're running an analysis and then be able to kind of apply that thinking to problems that I have in my own work.
So in going back to school, a lot of people want to move into a career where you can really have some impact, make a difference in the world, so to speak. How would you describe how you want to make a difference going forward?
Well, that's a funny one because, you know, you do hear that a lot, that I want to make a difference. And I remember actually it was at Stanford where I was hearing that a lot and thinking, how do I know that the difference I want to make is the difference that needs to happen in the world? Because that's actually pretty presumptuous. So I think part of the difference that I want to make has a lot to do with listening and reminding myself over and over and over again to listen to what people need and to remember to ask them instead of telling them what they need. And I'm telling you, that muscle atrophies really quickly. And I'm always disappointed in myself at how often I have to remember to ask people what they need and to not tell them what they need.
That's a keeper. It's a good reminder. So we haven't talked much about what you used to do, your previous life. Share, if you could, for people listening who aren't familiar with your career prior to the second act, what's one or two highlights that stick out in your mind as really enjoyable high moments that you experienced?
Of course, I'm going to answer with two. One of the most obvious one was when we played on Saturday Night Live and Ray Liotta was the guest, which, you know, now when I've told people in my classes that they don't know who he is, and that's an age difference that I'm choosing not to focus on. But that was just an amazing night. There were four after parties and it was just perfect, exactly how you'd want it to go. I do wish I had performed better, but I didn't see the recording for a week. So there was like a blissful week where I thought I had really killed it. And I got to enjoy that feeling for at least seven-ish days. And then the other one was on our first United States tour, we got to Austin and we were playing at a club called Emo's. And they have a big stage in the back that's outside. And they had, at that time, I don't know if it's there, actually Emo's might not even be in the same place anymore, but they had a small stage inside that was in the corner of the room. And we were playing like, you know, our 15-minute set, which is pretty much all we had. And it was the first show that anyone in the audience had ever sang along to. And we were just beside ourselves. We were like, how do they know the lyrics? Like, how is this happening? And it would just, I felt like as amazing at that point in time as I did when we were on Saturday Night Live. It was just like the pinnacle of amazingness to me.
A lot of work went into creating those moments leading up to those.
That's true. That's true. Yeah.
So what's next for you?
Well, being at all these graduation events and parties, I've had to answer that question a lot. And I can't say I'm really getting any better at it. It's kind of a mystery. I'm trying not to make any too many commitments. I'm trying not to kind of get like anxious and just like cling on to the first thing that crosses my path. So that's really difficult because I always am either in school or working since I was 18, at least, and before that. So I'm right at the point right now where I'm doing this internship, which is great because it gives me a little bit of stability and a little bit of a routine, but also I get to start looking for work and doing interviews. And I've done a bunch of informational interviews to see what kind of work I might want to do. But it's all pretty up in the air at the moment.
So if someone listening is thinking about going back to school, as you did, as I did, certainly from different paths, what advice would you offer them about making a move like that, going back to school? What should they be thinking about? What should they consider? What do you know that they may not?
I would just pass along advice that my mom gave me, which was I was complaining about being an older student and being behind, being late and all those concepts. And I was doing the math and I was like, oh no, when I graduate with my BA, I'll be 40. And she said, well, you'll be 40 anyway. So I think that's sort of like a point you really can't argue with. It's like, we're going to be aging, time will be passing, and we can either be working towards something that's exciting to us or just sort of like continuing on the path that we're on. And that doesn't mean you have to go back to school. I mean, you can stay at your job. You could improve your own job while you're there. You could do continuing education, or you could try to change your role or get a new job. But like, school is a great way to do that. And especially if you're not quite sure what you want to do, because it allows you to explore and kind of pretend to be a gerontologist for a while and pretend to be a psychologist for a while and see how that feels.
So you and I graduated from the same program, but just as a point of reference, I was 60 when I completed it. So you're way, way ahead, years, decades ahead of me by completing it this year.
I mean, it's like, if we can't embrace the fact that graduating at 60 is probably even cooler than graduating at 40 in gerontology, then our whole system is, you know, doomed. Like, there's no way. If we can't appreciate lifelong education in a gerontology program, I don't know what to say.
That's a key. And I was far from the oldest in my graduating class. We had some interesting people.
Amazing.
A couple in their 70s. And we also had an active NFL player in there as well.
Oh, that's amazing. Wow.
Also a former USC player was playing for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers at the time.
Oh, that's really cool.
So it was a diverse group of people going through that experience. So if you were to give people listening a sense for your best class that you had in gerontology, because some may be saying, what the heck is this gerontology thing anyway? What glimpse would you give them into your best class and what you took away from it?
This is a hard question to answer because I really did love all my classes and all my professors. And I even love some professors that I didn't get to have. So I have major FOMO because of that. So, I mean, I'd make the program longer if I could. But I would say the end of life class was really interesting and transformative. I happened to have a really good study group while I was in that class. So that also made it, you know, more enjoyable and just a richer experience. But it's kind of, I think, in a way, what you would expect in a gerontology program, because people do tend to clump aging and dying together. But I think it's really useful, you know, across the lifespan. I've definitely known and experienced people who died at a younger age, and that class has been really relevant to those experiences as well. So that one was great. Another elective I took was counseling with older adults and their families. And of course, we had an amazing teaching team with Paul Nash and Donna Benton. And I mean, you just can't go wrong with that duo and the way they interacted with each other, especially. But that was another class that I had a really great study group in. You know, the conversations that we had and kind of like the jokes that we made about little things like typos in a certain journal that we were reading, those things made the ideas stick with me. And I would be taking a test and I would be laughing out loud about, you know, something that I remembered from one of our study groups. And it's a heavy subject, you know, counseling older adults and their families is a lot about caregiving. It's a lot about, you know, loss of identity or trying to transform that into a strengths-based gaining of identity, but that's difficult. Again, death and dying. But I think that going through that with a good cohort and a good study group really helped me make it personal and make some of those ideas stick and kind of help us get more creative about how to focus on strengths instead of deficits.
So when I look at your bio, I see Stanford, UCLA, USC. Come September, who will you be rooting for during the football season?
I also went to Berkeley too, back in 97. I will be rooting for the helmet companies and universal healthcare.
There you go.
Yeah, I mean, just like everything with gerontology, it's cumulative. So if we damage our system at a young age, that's going to follow us. And so I just really hope and pray for people's brains.
That is a great answer. Brett Anderson, thank you so much for taking the time to join us. Very good answer.
Thank you.
Here are three takeaways I noted from this conversation with Brett Anderson today. Number one, could going back to school help set you on a new path? If you're considering a second act, whether it's paid or unpaid, getting some education and some training can be a really helpful place to start. And it doesn't have to be a full-on degree program. Take a look at courses that may be of interest to you and go in with an open mind. It could lead you down a road that's very, very helpful. Number two, who are you going to be now? After people retire, one thing that surprises them is that they get challenged and surprised by a question in social settings. So what do you do? And it gives them pause for a minute. So how will you answer that? Will it be about your past? Or will it be about the things you're preparing for or getting engaged in? So who do you want to be when you grow up, now that you've got a second chance? And number three, as Brett mentioned, humility goes a long way. It's important to let go of what you used to do and really take a humble approach to learning more about what you could do and want to do next. Thanks for listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. You can see all of our episodes at a glance at our website, retirementwisdom.com. It's 5 seasons, a lot of topics, great guests, and we will publish episodes each Monday and bonus episodes twice a month. Thanks again.
Just one more thing before you take off. Is it time to design your new life after you graduate from the world of full-time work? Go to retirementwisdom.com and schedule a call today with Joe Casey. Working with an experienced coach like Joe can help you explore new possibilities and gain clarity on your future. Thank you for listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. See you next week.